love your work. On this show, we meet people who have carved out success by their own definition. I'm David Cadavy, best-selling author and entrepreneur. Today's guest has built multiple seven-figure businesses. Now, I would reject that as a reason to admire someone in itself, but I've known her throughout the process, and she's made it look really easy. She's bootstrapped the whole way, she's traveled the world, and currently she works part-time. Laura Roeder is the founder of Edgar, which is, or maybe I should say who is, a social media automation tool. No offense, Edgar, but in all fairness, you are a tool. Edgar helps you create a library of social media updates that you can schedule to repeat. Laura has also been honored at the White House and spoke at the White House for being in the Impact 100, which is a list of the top young entrepreneurs in the U.S. And I've personally known Laura for about 8 years now, and I've always admired her decisiveness. I've never seen her really agonize over a big decision. So in this interview, I try to dig into the source of that decisiveness and the philosophy that drives it. One note in here is that I end up abandoning a story about how it is, as Laura puts it, that I'm responsible for her meeting her husband and CTO. First of all, she's giving me probably more credit than I deserve. But secondly, wait until later on in the interview, and we do eventually pick that story back up. So be patient. Here's the interview. This episode is brought to you by Treehouse. Take your career to the next level and learn from over 1,000 videos created by expert teachers on web design, coding, business, and much more. Claim your free 14-day free trial at cadavy.net/treehouse. You'll be supporting the show. I'm here with Laura Roeder right now. And Laura, when I was scheduling this podcast interview with your assistant, I was given the option that I could do the podcast interview this particular week in this particular month, or I could do the podcast interview in this same week, coinciding week, in the next month. So it made me curious, do you have a podcast week?
I do. I'm big on batching everything possible, and I have a podcast week. It's the first week of every month. We aim to schedule, I do a lot of them, we aim to schedule 4 podcasts a day, so I do 20 every month.
That's really fascinating to me, actually. So can you talk a little bit more about this batching idea?
So I handle the marketing for my company, and I'm really big on, I mean, with lots of things, but with marketing, you know, if you find something that works, try to optimize it and systematize it and batch it as much as possible instead of, you know, maybe getting small results from a lot of different activities. So we found that being on podcasts is something that's fun for me to do and is a great way to promote Edgar. It builds, you know, backlinks on all the different podcast show notes and people learn about me and the company. So I like to doing them. So I'm like, you know what, if I'm going to do podcasts, like I'm going to do some podcasts. And we get a lot of people that approach us because it's sort of a nice vicious cycle where when you appear on podcasts and other podcasts, they're like, maybe I'll be on my podcast. And then we also just look up the top lists in iTunes and approach them. So I do a lot of
podcasts. I'm aware of that. I've been getting a couple of those pitches. You weren't one of them, but
right. So at some point, like, we'll probably get through all the, you know, ones that are worth doing. And then I'll stop doing them, and then I'll have done all of them.
You'll have been on every podcast. Well, you might have to be on this one twice at some point. So do you find that preparing to do a podcast interview has any sort of gear shifting overhead to it, in which it makes it more efficient for you to do a bunch of them back to back in one particular day?
Sort of. I mean, I really don't prepare for them. But you know, you have to get in that sort of on mindset. I just have that mindset all week, which obviously I'm a person that likes to do. I think some people would find that really draining. Obviously I'm a person who likes to, have people listen to me talk. So
yeah, I spent maybe 5 hours doing video conferencing total yesterday, and I was totally exhausted. It's not something I would want to do, you know, every day for a whole week, for example.
Oh yeah, I love it.
But yeah, you can totally handle it. And I guess I also find that a lot of times it seems like a very low percentage of Skype or Hangout scheduled meetings actually happen at the time that they're scheduled.
Yes. Yes, this is a problem, and this is part of the reason we schedule so many. I mean, actually, you and I have rescheduled this because I was sick, or, you know, that happens, or sometimes people don't show up or people forget. So that's the other reason we schedule so many, is you end up doing most of them, but not all of them.
My killer thing is time zones, is that even, you know, I might be traveling, and even if I change the time zone to the time zone I'm in, then I'm trying to think about the time zone I'm going to be in when I actually do the thing, and
it's
somehow I end up getting mixed up sometimes.
Yeah, it's the worst. It's like, I feel like it's the biggest problem in my life that technology has not solved, is time zones.
I know. I think we should probably just all be like, oh, you know, let's, we'll be talking, and it'll be 2 a.m. where you are, which is the middle of the day in London or whatever. Just have the same time everywhere. Just go off GMT from now
GMT.
on.
GMT. This is what the English tried to do, but it didn't work out for them.
Oh, I didn't know that was the thing they tried to do.
I mean, I'm sort of making that up, but I feel like they were like, this is the time everywhere. I feel like that was the idea, but I just made that up.
That would make a really good story. So next thing is, what is the company you run is Edgar. What is Edgar? Actually, the better question might be, who is Edgar?
Who is that? Intriguing. So Edgar is a social media scheduling and automation tool for people who have a lot of content, for people who've been blogging or podcasting for a while, and you've built up this huge content library, and you never send it out on social media, and no one knows that it's there. You load up all your updates into Edgar, and then he sends them for you over and over again on autopilot. And Edgar is an octopus, and he's clumsy. We're actually just talking about how we need to compile a list of facts about Edgar. His favorite football team is the Tottenham Hotspurs. I know that.
Is that a team?
It is. It's the most ridiculous one we could think of. That's why it's his favorite team. Yeah, and he's like a friendly octopus that manages your social media for you.
And I could see how it could be really useful. I know I have a number of spreadsheets in my Google spreadsheets that maybe have links or updates to them. And I will write a script that will randomize the time at which they'll be scheduled, and then I'll export them to CSV, and then they'll put them in Hootsuite, and that might load in maybe, you know, 2 months worth of tweets or something, and then I will forget to ever do it again.
You really should use Edgar. It's sort of funny hearing you say that. I mean, you're like the perfect use case. Like, people that have all these complicated spreadsheets, you can just load it into Edgar once, and then...
And it would just reschedule some of the updates that have gone out. Because actually, I found that it's surprising. You know, some people are always being introduced to whatever it is that I have to offer. And I might have some article that's 5 years old, and then I might on a whim share it. And then there'd be some people who are like, oh, wow, this is a really cool article. And I assume that everybody's seen everything because to me, it's old news.
Which is sort of hilarious, right? When you think about what you're seeing, you're like, everyone on the internet has already read this article. Surely there's no one
who
hasn't come across this one yet, which is obviously false. So yeah, I mean, the whole idea, if you're on social media, you know, you want to be bringing in new followers all the time, so they haven't seen your old stuff. And people who already follow you are not, you know, they're not that meticulous, so they've read through 5 years of every article you've ever posted, and they never miss a link, you know?
Right. And you and I have known each other for a long time. I think it's probably been 8 years, I think. I met you back in Chicago in, I don't know, maybe around 2008 or something.
Yeah,
at that time.
Yeah.
And I think around that time, you and I each had like maybe 500 Twitter followers or something like that. And then you, at the time, were doing like freelance, like kind of small freelance jobs for local small businesses. And since then, you've built at least a couple of multi-million-dollar businesses. Mm-hmm. And 8 years might sound like a long time to some people, but that's extremely quick. What all happened between then and now?
So I've been in kind of the online marketing, social media space the whole time in various aspects and various businesses. So yeah, when I knew you, I was, or when we first met, I was doing websites for local businesses, and that kind of evolved into social media consulting because I would just talk to them about how people were going to find their site and what people were going to do once they were on their site. I just thought that's what you did when you made someone a website. I kind of found out later, like a lot of web designers don't do that. I just thought you were supposed to. And that was the work I did for free. You know, I built them the site, and then this, what I now see as consulting work, I didn't even think of it as that at the time. So when social media started to become this thing, I started, you know, people told me you could just do social media consulting. And I thought, sweet, that sounds super easy. I just talked to people about Twitter, you know, sign me up. So I did social media consulting, and that very quickly turned into the social media online training business, which turned into a bigger business. I also started B School with Marie Forleo, which is geared towards teaching women business owners about online marketing. And then I launched Edgar in 2014, which is my first software product. And we're now just over 2 million annual recurring revenue. So that's grown really fast, which has been really fun.
Yeah. So it sounds like a lot of the experience that you had with doing the social media consulting probably informed the genesis of Edgar.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, it's funny that you mentioned your spreadsheet, because that's, Edgar really came directly from training. We were teaching people how to put together these social media spreadsheets with all your updates, and that's what we were doing in our company. And then you cycle through them, but you have to, you know, load everything manually into the tool. So it was a very direct result of that, thinking, okay, why doesn't the tool do this for you? Why do you still have to do all this grunt work around your social media? This is something that software could handle. So, I mean, that's what Edgar does.
And actually, going back to starting to do the social media consulting and then doing the training business, I remember you and I were both freelancing back when we first met, and I remember having the impression, like, gosh, you're working with the wrong customers here. You're working with these small businesses, and they don't have any money for these for these small websites and stuff. But it sounds like you found a way to create a product that they could afford, but then there was like a huge market of them.
Yeah. I mean, it was a problem for sure, because when you're dealing locally, I was dealing with such a small set. Also, I've learned a lot since then. Like, I would try to convince people that didn't have a website. I thought, oh, they don't have a website, so they'll want to buy a website from me. I've since learned that you have to sell things to people who like already have the thing. You know, like, we sell Edgar to people who are already using a social media scheduling tool, not people who don't see the value in doing social media marketing. So I was definitely like barking up the wrong tree a lot, but I did see that small business owners are interested in learning about social media marketing. You know, it's a free marketing channel that they can pursue themselves. And the cool thing about the interwebs is, you know, it might be difficult to find enough of them to pay like $500 to learn how to do it, but there are so many small business owners around America or around the world. You can have a great business finding people who are willing to spend $500 to go through some training.
Yeah, so it was a lower touch solution than, say, the hands-on aspects of freelancing, but there was you were able to scale up enough where you weren't involved with it too intimately, that you could serve a lot of customers, and you could scale up the business that way. And then you turned that knowledge into software, where now it doesn't really, you don't have to do anything. I mean, I'm making it too simple, but.
Right. But yeah, I mean, as far as my involvement, it's very different because I went from, hours for dollars providing services. And now I run a software company, but I mean, I'm not a developer. So even if everything, like, I can't jump in, I don't know what to do. You know, I can't jump in and fix it. So it's definitely a company that runs without me. I mean, in particular for me, that's been a big focus for me. So I launched the company in 2014 when I was pregnant. I had my son in January 2015. I was on maternity leave for 3 months. I actually just work part-time now. So a lot of the growth has happened without, you know, me being there.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that you're able to work part-time and attend to other things and still run this lucrative business. Now, actually, stepping back even further, though, like when you first started, say, freelancing, what were you doing before you started freelancing?
So I started freelancing really young. I started working for myself when I was 22. So I only ever had one job, which was working at an agency for about a year and a half after college. I worked as a designer at an agency.
Yeah. And what was it like, kind of the moment that you decided that you weren't going to be doing that anymore, that you were going to start working on your own. Was that, did it just sort of gradually happen, or was there any abrupt moment when you were like, oh, this is probably not the right thing for me to be doing?
It's sort of both. I mean, I thought about it for a while and I thought, I'm not happy in my job. And, you know, should I switch jobs or should I switch career paths? But then I had this idea, basically I had the idea, well, if I work for myself, I can explore a lot of different things that I'm interested in, because I was a designer, and I'm not someone who's passionate about being a designer. You know, like, great designers, I feel like that's what they love. They don't want to do anything else. They would be happy doing that all day long. I was like, I liked it okay. I was okay at it. And I found it boring about my job that I only did design. And I was interested in all the other client side stuff, especially the marketing strategy type of stuff that the agency would do. So I'm like, well, you know, do I want to switch to be an account executive? Like, that looks like it sucks too. And I thought, oh, well, if I work for myself, I do all the client side stuff and I do the design stuff. And I had actually proposed in my job that I go part-time, because also I was just like sitting around bored, not doing anything. So I thought that would be a great win-win for them. Pay me part-time. I can still have that steady income. And they said yes, but then they said no, like 3 days before I was supposed to start part-time. They came back and they were like, well, if you work part-time, everyone's going to want to work part-time, which I thought, like, well, that'd be great because no one here is doing anything. That'd actually be a really smart move for
me.
But so that was like the catalyst that pushed me, you know, at that point I was already mentally like in my whole game plan of working part-time. So I wasn't going to go back to working full-time. So it was just like, okay, well then I quit.
So did you quit on the spot?
It wasn't like dramatic, but I mean, it was, yeah, in that conversation, I was like, okay, well, if you're, you know, if I can't work part-time, this isn't going to work out for me. I mean, I'm sure I was much less mature about it. Like, I'm sure I was very emotional about it at the time.
Like being 22 or so, right?
Right, right, yeah.
But you missed out on your opportunity to slam a door and make a dramatic exit, or do like the Jerry Maguire thing, yeah, where you try to take people with you.
That would have been hilarious. Like the junior designer, like, I'm leaving. Who's coming? No, I didn't. There was none of that.
You know, it's happened before somewhere. It's probably happening right now.
Well, it seems like a very stereotypical, like when you read things about like millennials and Gen Y, it's like one of those things you would read, like that they would stand up and like make a statement that they're leaving.
I'm leaving. Well, you also have to do the exit email where you're like, oh, this was it's either that or the email is like really about, this was such a great experience for me. And I just really, all the people and everybody who's reading it's like, yeah, whatever. Okay, go.
Right. No one cares.
So then you went out on your own, and I mean, I feel like that's a big turning point, is realizing that you are going out on your own. Did you feel like, oh, this is maybe a temporary thing, or did you feel convinced that you weren't going to work for other people? How did you feel about it at that time?
I think in the beginning, I didn't really know. I mean, I was excited to work for myself. I was definitely excited about the freedom from the beginning as well, because I remember one of my best friends visited me at the time. Like, she was living in LA and I was living in Chicago, and we would visit each other. And when she would visit me in Chicago, I would be like, okay, well, I get off work, you know, around 6:30. So like, we can have dinner together, and, you know, I get my like 4 days paid time off or whatever. So like, I can't take any time off. And when I would visit her, she actually worked at the time as a waitress. So it's not like she had some amazing career. She's an actress now, but she had the flexibility just being a waitress, you know, cause she could change her shifts, or she didn't have to work that day or whatever. And I thought, it sucks. Like, this sucks. My friend's visiting. I want to spend time with her and I can't, you know, why am I setting up my life that way? So, and I remember seeing people in coffee shops, if I ever had a day off, and you would go and you would like see people in coffee shops during the day. And you're like,
who are these people?
What are they doing? You know, like, I want to be them. So that was definitely something that I was excited about. And I think, I saw that it was the right path for me very soon after, because I've never had another job. I never went back and forth. I never worked for anyone else after that. So now I love working for myself. I would never get a job now.
Yeah. It's really a totally different existence. And it's interesting that you share this experience of visiting your friends who had this flexibility, or seeing people in coffee shops. I remember feeling that same thing, or seeing people walking, like sitting around in a park in the middle of the day, and you're like, what is this? Or having friends who are freelancers, and maybe you go out for a drink with them, and you're like, man, you don't actually really like have to go to work tomorrow, or like, when are you going to get up? And they're like, oh, you know, whenever I wake up, I don't have an alarm clock or something. And, you know, I think it, it takes a certain type of person or a certain type of things that a person has to value to see that and say, you know, regardless of the circumstances, that's going to be an important thing to me. Whereas some people, I think, they worry that, oh, I won't make as much money or something, which hasn't been the case for you. I won't make as much money, or they'll place something else of value above it. And, you know, it sounds like you made it a priority to have that flexibility. Yeah. And that's carried over into your life today, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have a lot of unrealistic fears about, one, you know, quitting their job and working for themselves, because the worst case scenario is that you get another job. You know, the very worst case scenario is you get a job that's not as good for a few years, and maybe you have to like take a while to work your way back up. But it's like, okay, so your worst case scenario is back where you started. I mean, most of us are lucky enough to have a network of friends and family. You know, most people listening to this podcast are not going to be homeless. It's not. Yeah. I mean, there are some people out there that are in that situation that, you know, grew up without a family or whatever, and it's a lot harder. But, you know, I know I'm like most people in that I have random cousins that I've never met that I could show up at their house and be like, can I sleep here for a week? And they'd be like, all right, you know, like you're not going to starve to death if you don't do well working for yourself. Like, you'll go get a job. You might have to get a job at Walmart. That would suck, but it's not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, I remember having those sort of conflicts myself. And I remember one conversation in particular with somebody who was, I was thinking about starting something, and he was like, all right, worst case scenario, you go work on this thing for a few months, and then when you go look for another job, you get to tell them that you ran your own company.
Right, right.
And are they not going to want to hire you?
Yeah.
When you do that? And unfortunately, that didn't happen to be the case. Yeah, and for me, like, I had to have quite a bit of money saved up in the bank before I like stopped freaking out about whether I was going to just disintegrate the moment that I did.
It just doesn't make sense. Yeah. When you think it through, because it's like, if I were to not have that much savings, you know, you would bring money in, right? Like, if you did run out of money too early, then yeah, you would go get some sort of crappy job just to be able to survive. And it's fine if people want to save up more money or whatever makes you feel good about it. The part that's not fine is if you're living in fear, or if you don't like your life and you want to make a change, but you're too scared to do it. That's what's like, that's not cool.
Right. Yeah. And that's totally me. And it didn't happen until somebody changed it for me. You know, they fired me. And then, but at the moment that it happened, I was like, oh, this is like going to be the greatest day of my life. Right. And I had a bunch of money in the bank saved up, and the first couple of weeks was just getting acquainted with the idea that I wasn't going to disintegrate. That yeah, my bank account would go down a little bit in the course of a month,
right.
And that I would still exist as a human. And but it also opened up this wide expanse of time that had to be filled up with something.
Yeah, that's why you hang out with other freelancers. That's why we were friends.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think we had lunch or something, and it was, you know, maybe an hour and a half lunch in the middle of the day. And oh, do I have to get back to the office? No. Well, okay. Well, I guess it's time to go back and work on some stuff.
Right, and you do like the co-working at the coffee shop, where you just hang out. I'm still a big fan of that. I do that all the time.
Yeah, I like coffee shops too. It's more of an afternoon activity for me, yeah. I think, but mornings happen to be more like creative time for me, I think. You've done a lot in a short amount of time. Are there any qualities that you think have enabled you to do that? Any qualities inherent to you?
I mean, I think I'm definitely very optimistic in how I see things. It's hard for me, you know, as we mentioned, I do a lot of podcasts and sometimes people will be like, tell me about your biggest failure. And it sounds fake, but I'm really like, I don't know. And it's not because everything goes well for
me
all the
time. I want
to
ask that question.
It's not because everything goes well for me all the time, but it's because I genuinely see it all as just part of the process, and you have to try things out and you have to learn from them, and some of them work out and some of them don't. And, you know, a lot of things don't pan out the way that you thought they would. So, I mean, I think having that outlook is extremely helpful because it makes you not fearful. And I think I'm good at judging risk. And to me, being good at judging risk means that things are actually not as risky as a lot of people think they are. I mean, as we just talked about with the whole risk of going out to work for yourself, you know, you might have like a down year and you'll kind of get your career back on track and you'll go back to the job you didn't like or another one you don't like or whatever, but that's where you started. And as a company, I think one of the sort of best ways to be a more successful company quicker is to do things that other people are maybe scared to do, or to do things that the rest of your industry doesn't do. And you look around and you're thinking, oh, nobody else does it this way. Maybe I should just stick to the script. I mean, this has been interesting for me being in SaaS, because there's a way that people do things in SaaS. And a lot of it, I don't
think.
Software
as a service, just as a
clarification. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think a lot of it makes a lot of sense. Like, there's this thing about how you have to have a free trial, or now this is sort of changing. It used to be you had to have a freemium model and you had to have a free plan. And a lot of companies now are cutting the free plan, where I'm like, we're a bootstrapped company. We can't have a free plan. You know, we can't afford to support a bunch of free users. And we're not a charity. We're like a service you pay for in your business. Like, we're for businesses to do marketing. Like, why wouldn't people pay for that? So, yeah.
Kind of zig when others zag.
Yeah, I think so. And just doing things the way that you want and not being so worried if other people think that's the right thing to do.
Are there any kind of big bets that you've made in that sort of thing where something that you did that seemed very counterintuitive that paid off for you, or that didn't?
I mean, one is just the branding of Edgar. You know, you said, who is Edgar? And when we decided on the name and we did sort of a formal branding process, I remember we talked about the character of Edgar, and my husband, Chris, who's our CTO, who you know because you're responsible for Chris and I meeting and therefore my whole life happening.
We're going to have to cover that eventually. We can't just...
So he thought this idea of having a character, it was just the worst idea. He was like, it's going to be like Clippy. Everyone's going to hate the software. It's going to be so annoying. And I'm like, no, you did the development, you know, leave the marketing to me. It's going to be actually really fun. And people have really latched onto it. Like, whenever we read reviews, people always call Edgar he, and they'll start the reviews. They'll be like, I met a new guy. He's really doing a lot for me. His name is Edgar.
He's a machine.
Right. But that was a risk. It's not what most companies do. Although now I see, I don't know if I just noticed because I have one with a person's name, but I notice a lot of companies that are a person's name. We don't have an affiliate program. That's a very unpopular decision. You know, our customers complain about it a lot that we don't have an affiliate program, but I had this bad experience looking up software and I could only find affiliate reviews. And I thought, this isn't helpful at all. I want to read real reviews. And I didn't want people to have that experience Googling my company. So that's a few examples.
Yeah, it actually reflected poorly on your perception of the companies that you read, that reviews you were reading were obviously they were being compensated and such.
Right. Because you never get a totally honest review. You know, people will be like, well, here's the pros and cons, but you know, you should give it a try because they're getting paid if you give it a try. And I just wanted people to be able to Google Edgar, find real reviews and know that they're 100% the real experience of the person writing them.
Right. Just to, I guess, wrap in to explain to people how it is that I might be responsible for the... your marriage into the life of your son is that I, several years ago, I think it was almost 4 years ago exactly.
2012.
Yeah, where I kind of tweeted out like, hey, I'm going to go to Buenos Aires for the winter. Does anybody want to come? And then you were like, I'll go. And then we just like had a quick Skype chat and stuff. And like, all right, well, you know, if you decide that you want to go and you're like, no, I'm going. Like you had just decided then. Like, okay, yeah I'm going. You had just decided. So, I mean, that's one thing that that's a quality that I've noticed in you. And I think I would posit has a lot to do with your rapid success is that you are very decisive. You don't. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever seen you like really mull something over, and it could be that I haven't been privy to it.
No, I think you're right.
Would you agree with that?
I'm not a muller.
Yeah, and I totally am, because I know that actually 4 years ago I had a conversation with you where I was like, you know, I was thinking about having a podcast, and now it's finally happening. You know, 4 years later. Is that a quality that you always had, the decisiveness, or was it something that you eventually discovered and decided to double down on?
I think it's something that I probably have naturally more than a lot of people, but it's something that I have also cultivated, because I do think it's a really important skill, is just making quick decisions. Because once you decide, you can see how it goes. This is the problem, right? If you're just thinking about doing a podcast for 4 years, in that whole 4 years, you're not able to improve the podcast. You're not able to see, you know, what topics people like, or if it's going to do well, or if it's not. You don't know any of those things until you make it, until you launch it. And then you can make all those adjustments. So I've just seen how important it is to just put something out there, to just make it live, to do it, and then you can see how it goes. So it is something that I try to be conscious of, and that I consciously do for a lot of decisions. Like, I'm in a house now that was custom built. So you have to make a lot of decisions when you custom build a house. So there were constantly things that we were just like, we're just going to go to the store and we're going to pick the faucet today. So whatever faucets they have here, whatever's our favorite one, like, we're done. There's no more.
It'll be done and you'll be happy with it.
Right. Because you don't actually care that, like, afterwards you're like, you don't notice the faucet. Like, it's fine. It's not this important thing in your life, but it's easy to spend like a month looking at faucets.
This is something I very slowly noticed. We're like, I recently got like a pair of shoes and it arrived in the mail, and it wasn't quite the color that I expected them to be, but I was leaving for an extended trip soon. I'm like, well, I need these shoes. I guess I'm wearing these shoes, but I reminded myself, like, you know, they probably seem like shoes that aren't exactly what you'd like right now, but within 2 weeks, I guarantee that you're either not going to care or you're actually going to like them just fine. Have you found that to be true?
Yeah, I had that happen the other day. I bought this like Kindle cover and it came and it was all scratched. So I'm like, oh, God damn it. It's all scratched. But I'm like, you know what? It's just going to get scratched up anyway. Like I have a 1-year-old, like, he's going to mess with it. He's going to scratch it up. And so why do I care? Like, do I really want to go through the trouble of sending it back and like worrying about how it's scratched, or am I just going to use it? I don't actually care at all that it has scratches on it. And it's just a much easier way to live your life.
Yeah. So were there any times when you started to, when you like first realized, oh, that was decisive. I did that more decisively than most people do. And you became aware of that quality so that you could cultivate it.
I'm trying to think of a good story. I mean, I can definitely remember.
Because it does sound like you kind of maybe mulled over a little bit going freelance.
Yeah. And I also have definitely I mean, it's not like I'm always so decisive. So recently I was invited to speak at something and I found myself really stressing out about like asking for a fee or what the fee should be. You know, a lot of people don't get paid to speak, right? So I'm like, who am I asking for money? They probably don't pay anybody. And I definitely will catch myself when I'm doing that and just sort of try to remind myself, like, why? Like, why? Why am I going through this mental anguish? And try to remember that there's no right answer. I mean, I think that's kind of the secret in all this, is that the right answer is not going to come to you. It's not like if I obsess about this for a month, I will land on the perfect speaking fee that I will be, you know, happy to offer and everyone will accept. And like, that's just not real. So you're going through this anguish, like trying to find something that's not there. And Yeah, I wish I had a better story to illustrate that. I just try to nip it in the bud, you know?
I mean, yeah. I mean, if I can add to that, I can think of so if you're thinking the very fact that you're thinking about the speaking fee instead of just being like, oh, hell yeah, I want to go to talk at this thing, it tells you that there's something inside of you that makes you maybe not comfortable with that, but you are agonizing over whether to ask for it, but it's better to just go ahead and ask for it. And also the mental anguish or mental stress that you go through in considering whether or not to ask for the speaking fee actually comes from a pool of cognitive and emotional resources that could be used for something else.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And if you kind of, I'm a big fan of just sort of like logically thinking the situation through. And I was talking to Chris about this speaking fee and how I was worried about it. So he's like, well, think about what's really going to happen, you know, because my fear is that I'm going to come across like a jerk, which it just doesn't really make any sense. Like I'm going to come across as this jerk who's super full of myself. And he's like, if this guy wrote back, if you ask for the fee and then he wrote back, like, who do you think you are? Like, what would you think? You would think that guy's the jerk, obviously. You would be like,
yes.
Whoa, that's crazy. I did not expect that reaction. So if you kind of think through what you're worried about, I mean, I think it's very often totally ridiculous, whatever this like scenario is that you think is going to happen.
Yeah, we'll put a story in our head about what, how people are going to react to something and even what the consequences of that reaction are. Like if that guy did respond with that, then you'd be like, well, I'm glad that I'm not doing business with a person
exactly.
like that. Really, quite honestly. That was one thing I always kind of thought about people who would, who were designers who would maybe complain about problem clients, which sometimes it's, you don't have control over it, but you know, you realize, wow, this person's actually a really bad business person because they're meddling with this logo design with a person that they hired to do this thing. I probably shouldn't do business with them. It's a debt to my detriment, in fact.
Yeah. Oh, I have some stories there with some people that I worked with early on that were just, just like real, real jerks, which I will always remember if someone is like that.
Well, and some people just go ahead and take that for their whole career.
Right.
And just kind of say, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. And then other people decide, well, I'm not going to deal with something like that again.
Yeah. Yeah. I was definitely the latter of being like, oh, you have shown me who you really are. I don't think I want to work with you anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like that's worked out just fine. So it's interesting also that you started off as a designer, and that's kind of a creator role. Like you're sitting there, you're creating stuff, but now you're a manager.
Mm-hmm.
Like you are managing a lot of people. You've got your hands out of the operation enough that, you know, you're working part time on it. Was there any process through which you started to recognize those qualities about yourself that, oh, you know, I don't really want to sit in a chair all day and create stuff and that you actually do enjoy the process of managing and that you are talented at managing? Myself, I've tried managing and it just doesn't stick with me.
I think actually I did recognize that pretty early because in retrospect, I had help very early on in the process, much sooner than most people do. So even when I was working as a freelance designer, and I was making, you know, about like $50,000 a year, I had a sort of like intern assistant, whatever, a woman named Martine. And she, like, I hired her to help me do some of the junk I didn't like doing, some of the administrative stuff. And, you know, a lot of people have a lot of hangups about hiring and about letting go and delegating. And I've always felt like somebody else wants to do this work that I don't want to do. Sounds great. You know, that just sounds absolutely fantastic. So I'm a pretty natural delegator, I would say. And always in my businesses, like, I've never tried to really do a business alone, you know, even though I haven't always had like co-founders, I've always built a team of people around me to help me, because I just view it as this great thing. Like, oh, there's people out there that love doing customer service, or there's people out there that love doing bookkeeping, and we can trade the money for the bookkeeping and they'll do it and everyone's happy. It's like, it's a good system.
So did you ever struggle with the idea that, oh, I have to give money to get this thing done, and do I have the money to pay somebody to do it, you know, because I have to pay somebody money to do this thing before I can make the money to to pay the person?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the eternal bootstrapper struggle for sure. But I did see that you can kind of pay for everything in scales. You can get like worse people to do it for cheaper, or better people to do it for more, or obviously just people to do it for more time.
Yeah.
So I saw, I mean, that's really how I've, you know, built my companies bootstrapped. Like, I've hired positions part-time freelance that most people don't really view as part-time freelance positions, like a project manager. I brought a project manager into my social media training company, again, much earlier than I think most people would do that. I mean, I'm in a group of like startup software founders, and they were talking about how some of them were just considering bringing on a person to do kind of operations and project management and administrative stuff. They're still doing all this stuff themselves, you know, in their funded startup. So I just was like, okay, well, if I have 10 bucks, like, find someone who can do 10 bucks worth of whatever it is I need done. I think for me and for a lot of people, it was just more of a mindset issue of, will someone really want to work with me? Like, is my company legit or important enough or whatever to be able to hire a project manager, for example? That one in particular was this big dream that I had, and I thought, well, I'm just not big enough for that to happen.
Oh, so you had to kind of get over an internal kind of inferiority complex over whether somebody would be excited to work for you.
Right. Like, thinking my company wasn't a real company, which is definitely something I've struggled with a lot, is thinking that for whatever reason, what I'm doing isn't as legitimate or serious or important as what other people do.
Yeah, I think that's something that takes time. It's for me, in the beginning of having a company, it was hard for me to wrap my head around, like, oh, so I'm not, it's like a person who does stuff, and this is supposed to be a company, and it's like a thing that is like got a different bank account, and like, it's a different thing. And that if I want to say that this thing is like really big and huge and successful, and then people will just maybe sort of believe me and decide that they will
right.
work for it. Like,
right.
And
right,
that's really
right.
What every company is
just, right. And I think it really helps to see your friends have those experiences and to get to see companies that you thought were really impressive, and then you see that they're just sort of throwing everything together as well.
Yeah, exactly. Or that, you know, even the systems of how things work out, you think that there's going to be this sophisticated internal thing, and like, no, we've got Google Docs. And,
right.
You know, we just do this part manually.
Right.
Because we tried to write a program, but it was just too complicated. We didn't do it. Things like that.
And you see, I remember like when you got your book deal, that was so exciting. And I mean, that was very exciting to me to like be, wow, my friend is really important, you know, like he's like speaking at South by Southwest and he's got this book deal. So like, you see your friends do these impressive things and you're like, but he's like, he's just David, right? He's not that impressive. If he could get a book deal, you know, but yeah. It really does help you see that it's like, okay, he is just a normal person. And through this series of, you know, coincidences and things that he proactively made happen, this thing happened for him and then he made the most of it. And you also do see like the people that are successful, that how much work that takes and how proactive they've been in choosing the things that got them there.
Yeah, that's such an interesting observation too, because when, you know, even if I consider a certain project, oh, like considering doing this podcast or something, before it exists, before you make it exist, it's so hard to like get over that threshold. But then you realize, once you do make something exist, then all this energy sort of rallies behind it, where it becomes this thing that is in the world now, and you know, then suddenly you get a lot of support. Like, oh yeah, would Laura want to be interviewed on the podcast? Yeah. Oh, actually she would. That's good.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Things like that, that you wonder about before you actually start the project, but it's much easier once it actually exists and is there.
Right. Right. Because it's real and people can engage with it and people can share it and
yeah,
it's a real thing.
Oh, we've had such an interesting conversation. I know that we're really approaching the end of our time, and I realized that I totally abandoned the story about how Buenos Aires has anything to do with your family. But I guess long story short is you came to Buenos Aires and then you met your husband.
Right, right. Yeah. Thanks to you and Kunal.
Oh, right. Yes. Kunal.
Yeah. So yeah, my husband was having a party and you got invited to that party by Kunal, I think. And so, yeah, we went there, my first day in Buenos Aires. And so, yeah, you're responsible for me meeting my husband, who then, you know, made the business with me. So you're responsible for Edgar. We had a baby. So, I mean, it's all, there's a lot there.
All right. So, and actually, you know, just to go butterfly effect on the whole thing, the fact that I even went to Buenos Aires was because I went and spoke in Chile because somebody from Chile approached me at 500 Startups when I went to talk there because somebody at 500 Startups saw that I was traveling in the Bay Area and said, oh, hey, come do a talk today. And I just kind of went down there. As that person from Chile said, hey, do you want to go to Chile? And that connected me with Latin America. And now I'm in Colombia.
Right.
And that's kind of all connected too. And it's amazing where things will end up if you'll just leave yourself open to opportunities that open in front of you.
Yeah. And, you know, it's also a great example. Like something else that I'm a big believer in is all opportunities come from other people, which I think we spend so much time kind of trying to engineer plans and think of how we want things to go. But actually every opportunity involves another human. That's the nature of it. Someone has to, you know, invite you to speak or invite you to the party or say that they'll share the cost of the apartment with you or whatever it is. And that serendipity isn't sort of this like extra thing. I think we tend to think of it as like, oh, I have my plan, and then maybe there'll be this like serendipity that's sort of piled on the top. But it's not this extra thing. It is everything.
Serendipity. Yeah, I have this idea of inviting serendipity. Mm-hmm. You know, leaving yourself open to the idea that serendipitous things will happen because the opportunities are right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if it's as simple as like walking a different route on the way to work in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess I have a few rapid fire questions towards the end here. There's only so many we have time for. What's the biggest compromise that you've made in getting where you are?
Oh God. The biggest compromise that I've made. That's a really hard question. I mean, I guess what's sort of related, what comes to mind is a big reason that I wanted to start a software business is in my training business, I was the face of the business. So it was like training by Laura Roeder, and I taught the classes and, you know, my pictures on the homepage, and it's very much about me. And I had a real love-hate with that. I guess you could call it like a style of marketing. And it's like obviously something that feeds my ego, right? Like I talked about how I do 20 podcasts a week. Like obviously I'm the type of person that's like, other people like me, you know?
Yeah, it's good. I'm no different.
Yeah, but some people are, some people aren't. So, you know, it's nice to have that like ego gratification. And as a marketing strategy, I also think it's an incredibly effective marketing strategy. I think whenever you put like a human in front of the company, that always works really well because people like having someone to connect with, which is why, you know, we can still use that strategy, me doing podcasts talking about Edgar, even though I'm not the face of Edgar. But I feel like that's a compromise that I made and that I struggled with, like, I'm going to give up a certain amount of my freedom in order to be the front person of this company, because I created a structure that was very dependent on my time. And even when I got farther along, like after a while, I would have ghostwriters write everything. So I didn't even have to write it myself anymore, but I still had to pretend that I wrote it, which is, you know, I got rid of the commitment and the doing, but it's still like this
level. Somebody on a podcast might ask you a question about something that you ghost wrote.
Right. It's still this like level of commitment of being there. And that was a compromise.
Oh, that's a great answer. What was the last book that you read that changed the way you saw something?
Oh, well, this morning I was reading a book called, I think it's called Debt, The First 5,000 Years. Do you know that book?
I don't. Sounds interesting.
It's about the history of debt. And I learned about what the IMF is, which I didn't actually know before. I had like this vague idea.
International Monetary Fund, which I don't know much about.
Yeah. It's totally like unrelated to anything we've talked about on this podcast. Yeah, I would say it like changed my worldview in a small way because I understood more about, especially about how different countries interact with each other financially, which, you know, it's interesting going more into business and like you make more money in business. So now, like I said, you know, we're at like $2 million, which to me seems like this really big business, but obviously in the scheme of business is this really, really tiny thing. And as you kind of move up the financial ranks, you start to get this little peek into how things work differently, like when you do have more money. Like, for example, now it's really easy for us to get a line of credit for a lot more money, or we can have an Amex balance of like $70,000 and that's fine. So it's, and I got this thing, I actually sent it to Ramit because I knew he would love it. Ramit Sethi, I got this thing in the mail that was like special mortgages for like rich people, which I got on this list somehow. And it was like, you can get a mortgage without putting any money down because you can leverage your family trust for your mortgage. Like, you know, assuming you have like a trust fund.
You have a trust fund.
Yeah. Which I don't, for the record.
Yes.
I make my own. It's just like, it's always interesting to me to learn about, you kind of think you know how something works and then you realize, oh, I only know how that thing works in my own tiny little world.
Oh, absolutely. That applies to anything in life. Next question. Do you make your bed?
No. Don't be ridiculous. I don't understand. I inherently do not understand the making of beds. It's weird.
I'm amazed at how many podcast guests are totally with you on that.
You probably make your bed. Do you make your bed?
I do now. I do now, but I was always like, no. I make it to the point where I used to do the whole tuck-in thing and mm-hmm. like make it all neat. And it's neat when you come back to the bed at night and you're like, oh, it's clean. And like, but then actually it was Jason Fried who was like, I throw the bed sometimes. And I was like, oh, that's right. I hate having to kick the sheets from underneath
right.
the mattress. And so now I just place it over, but I at least like make it look smooth and stuff. And that's like kind of part of my morning ritual. It's all really just to organize the chaos that is in my own brain or to give some sense that there is a way to organize all of it.
That you have some control over this life spinning out from under you.
Yes, it's because I'm a control freak. Exactly. do you have a final message for everybody?
Oh, final message. A final message is that you can do stuff that you've never done before. You know, I think that's really important to remember. Like, I, for a long time, wanted to start a software company, but I didn't really know how that would work, and I didn't really have an idea that I thought was good enough. And I still don't know how to build software, but now I have a software company. And I think we get really stuck in, like, I don't know how to do that, or I don't have those skills. But, you know, unless you're 98 years old, hopefully you have a long life ahead of you. And if you're in your 30s or in your 40s or in your 20s, it would be so crazy to limit what you do for the rest of your life based on what you've done already.
That's fantastic advice. Life is long.
Hopefully.
This is what I like to say. Hopefully, if you're lucky, life is long.
Yeah.
And where can everybody find you?
You can find Edgar at meetedgar.com and meet Edgar on Twitter and Facebook. And on Twitter, I am LKR.
Great. That is total hacker cred that Twitter had, by the way. Three letters. I wish I had something like that.
It's pretty cool.
Anyway, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and for chatting with me. It's been fantastic having you on the show.
Thank you.
So, there we have it. Before I go, I gotta ask, do you like books? If you do, I'd love to send you my book recommendations. About 90% of them will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to cadavy.net/reading, sign up, and you'll get my first set of recommendations right away. You'll be supporting the show if you buy any of those books through the links in the email. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is CNU, performed by The Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.